listening to the Book Club at 91.7 here on WVXU and WMUB. Good morning. I'm Mark Purcell. On the phone with me from London is Roland White. I've enjoyed his writing about aviation history in the past in books like Vulcan 607 and Phoenix Squadron. And now Roland has brought out a new book called Into the Black. It's the extraordinary untold story, the first flight of the space shuttle Columbia and the astronauts who flew her. Roland White, welcome to the Book Club at 91.7.
Thanks, Mark. It's great to be on the show.
It's 35 years ago, in April of 1981, that the space shuttle Columbia blasted off from Cape Canaveral, the first flight of the space shuttle that had been in development for quite some time. Was it just the anniversary, or why now, Roland, did you decide to write this story?
Well, I mean, the anniversary certainly was helpful. It wasn't actually the reason that I took an interest in the subject. It was the last uncovered kind of aviation event that had really captured my imagination as a kid. I mean, I was born in 1970, and so I was too young for the Apollo missions. And 1975 was the last time American astronauts had launched in my lifetime. And so, for 6 years, I'd been waiting for the excitement of a space launch. And it just so happened that in 1981, it was the space shuttle that first returned American astronauts to space. And so, as a result, it was the shuttle that really captured my imagination. And what's more, it was like science fiction made real. It wasn't just the sort of the bare minimum required, get people into space and back, a little capsule. It was this huge thing the size of an airliner that could carry a crew of 7 or 8 people on a 2-week mission before sort of sweeping back to Earth and landing on a runway. So, as I say, my sort of Buck Rogers or Flash Gordon made real, and I desperately wanted to write a book that celebrated this sort of incredible machine.
Well, you really point out in Into the Black how the space program made that transition from what you call the capsule days, if you may, of Apollo and Gemini and Mercury and the like, to this rocket plane. And that was a transition that happened because of military involvement.
Well, to a large extent, yeah. I mean, there was certainly a good deal of thought about what was going to follow Apollo. And, NASA had grand plans for, 100-man-strong space stations around the moon bases, missions to Mars, and the rest. But the only thing which survived sort of budgetary cuts and things post-Apollo was the space shuttle. Their reasoning being that if they built a space shuttle, a space station could reasonably follow, but not the other way around. But the size and the shape of the space shuttle was very much a result of the military's requirements, because in order to afford to fly the shuttle, they needed to fly it often in the hope that it would bring the prices down. And in order to fly it as often as possible, it was decreed that the military were going to have to launch all their spy satellites and reconnaissance satellites on board the shuttle. And that meant the shuttle had to be capable of carrying these enormous spy satellites, which were the size of Greyhound buses. And it also meant that it had those distinctive delta wings, because that was necessary for the shuttle on its way home after just a single orbit to be able to return back to Vandenberg Air Force Base, the launch site, rather than being forced to ditch in the sea. So the size of the shuttle and the shape of those wings were a direct result of the military's requirements, yeah.
Well, and a manned orbital laboratory was something that was in the plan for some time, because we're talking going back to Eisenhower, where they wanted information on what was happening in Russia. And there was, back in the day, just no easy way. I mean, in this day of Google Earth and, pictures of satellites everywhere, people don't realize that just a few decades ago, that wasn't possible.
You're right, we're used to it now, but in 1957, all they had were these U-2 spy planes, and they realized, those who were sort of looking ahead, that it wasn't going to be long before those got shot down. And indeed, Gary Powers was shot down. And around the same time, America introduced its first spy satellites, and it was quickly a program that became sort of deeply classified and came under the auspices of a new organization called the National Reconnaissance Office. And the National Reconnaissance Office was a branch of the U.S. intelligence fraternity, like the CIA or the NSA. But, until the 80s, even the existence of the NRO, National Reconnaissance Office, was classified. If you worked there, you couldn't tell your wife you worked there. Its existence was unknown, but all of those spy satellites that the shuttle carried, and by the early 70s, the possibility of delivering photographs back digitally in real time was coming onto the horizon, were completely classified, but were all going to be carried on board the shuttle. And it was the promise of those digital spy satellites, the ones that could transmit pictures back, that actually put the astronauts who'd been training for the manned orbiting laboratory, which was going to be the military's space station, a sort of manned spy satellite, if you will, that put those astronauts out of a job, because the president realized you couldn't afford a manned spy satellite and an expensive digital satellite, and he had to make a choice between the unmanned system or the manned system. So these guys were all out of a job, and it was NASA who gave the seven youngest of them a lifeline and employed them in the astronaut office of the civilian space program. So from being military astronauts throughout the 60s, they joined NASA and then became central to the development of the space shuttle.
Roland White, he's the author of Into the Black, The Extraordinary Untold Story of the First Flight of the Space Shuttle Columbia and the Astronauts Who Flew Her. More details about the book, of course, at our website, wvxu.org. And these men that we meet as, I read Into the Black, the scientists that are involved, the engineers, the astronauts, there's quite a few people involved in this program. I'm not sure that the public realizes the massive manpower behind these projects.
No, I mean, the scale of these projects is absolutely immense. And the shuttle was, the program director described it as beyond the state of the art. You know, they had to develop rocket engines that were reusable and that were more powerful per pound in weight than anything that had been flown before. They had to design a heat shield that, instead of having to protect an area the size of a, you know, big dining room table, had to protect an area the size of a tennis court from temperatures that were generated by reentry that were as high as those found on the surface of the sun. And they also had to produce, you know, very sophisticated and again, really cutting-edge computer and avionics systems that would allow this incredible machine to launch like a rocket, perform like a spacecraft in space, and then turn to Earth like an aircraft. You know, nothing like this had ever been attempted before. And as I said, I really wanted to celebrate that incredible achievement, that incredible engineering achievement. What I hadn't bargained on when I started the research for the book was that there was a sort of untold story at the heart of that first mission that turned it into a kind of, you know, Apollo 13 or Gravity-style thriller, real-life thriller. And, trying to bring that to life was both a challenge and a privilege.
We'll get to that adventure in just a moment, but I have to say you must have been thrilled getting the chance to talk to some of these astronauts that were involved in the program.
Oh, for sure. I mean, I mentioned that I was 10 or 11 years old when the shuttle launched. If you'd told me then that a few years down the track I was going to be talking and meeting to the astronauts who flew her during that first flight, I'd have probably blasted off myself in excitement. I mean, I couldn't have imagined something more thrilling.
That first flight of the Columbia had just two astronauts. We're, of course, in the later missions used to many astronauts and specialists and scientists on board. But that first one, after much testing, was fronted by two astronauts, John Young and Bob Crippen. And these two men, well, this took test pilot right to the nth degree.
I did. I mean, they talk about the right stuff. These guys had it. I mean, John Young was, by 1981, NASA's most experienced astronaut. He'd flown a couple of Gemini missions. He'd flown on Apollo 10 to the moon, although they didn't land on that mission. And then he had walked on the moon when he commanded Apollo 16. And Bob Crippen was one of those refugees from the MOL program that we talked about earlier. And this was his first ever space flight. Bob Crippen had been trained by Chuck Yeager's test pilot school in the Edwards Air Force Base, and both were naval aviators as well. I mean, these were guys who were incredibly courageous, because that first shuttle mission was unique. Never before and never since, and I don't think this will ever happen again, had a manned spacecraft been launched with a crew on board when there had never been an unmanned sort of test flight prior to that. So this was the first time a manned spacecraft had ever been launched for the first time with a crew on board rather than first being tested. And so, you know, they were incredibly brave, courageous men to strap themselves on top of that rocket. Now, John Young actually said himself that, you know, anybody who straps themselves onto the top of the world's largest hydrogen-oxygen explosion and is not a little bit anxious doesn't fully appreciate the gravity of the situation he's in.
7 million pounds of thrust escaping
That's
Earth's
right.
gravity. Into the Black, the extraordinary untold story of the first flight of the Space Shuttle Columbia and the astronauts who flew her. I'm speaking with author Roland White, the true story of the Space Shuttle Columbia. And from the beginning, it is something that has been a concern, it seems, all through the Space Shuttle, or was a concern all through the Space Shuttle program, and that first flight, the heat tiles. The heat tiles were kind of causing a problem for quite a bit of time.
Yeah, I mean, they were the big challenge throughout the 70s, was getting this heat shield to work. I mean, the rockets, while they blew themselves up on the test stands, actually progressed relatively smoothly to being man-rated. But these tiles, which were a brand new way of protecting a re-entering spacecraft from the sort of blowtorch heat of re-entry, were a new thing. And NASA thought they had it cracked. You know, they developed a substance which conducted heat so badly that it could protect the aluminium skin beneath them from that heat. But what they'd sort of neglected to do in developing the substance was at the same time develop a really foolproof way of sticking them to the airframe. And as soon as they started flying the space shuttle across the country from where it was built in California to Florida, where she was going to be launched, they realized they just fell off. And this was potentially a showstopper. I mean, you couldn't, if the tiles were going to fall off, the shuttle was stranded. She wasn't going to be able to come home. And an engineer at Houston came up with a solution that they thought had that problem cracked. They sort of painted a paste on the bottom of the tile, and it increased the strength of the connection to the airframe. So they thought they had it nailed. Until that launch, when unexpected shockwaves caused by the noise of the ignition of those solid rocket boosters, that 7 million pounds of thrust you talked about, knocked tiles loose from the airframe. Well, they had run tests to try and establish what sort of shockwave would hit the shuttle, and they'd come to some conclusions, but they were the wrong conclusions by a factor of about 10. And so when they got into space, the astronauts looked back from the cockpit, and they realized there were tiles missing. And this caused near panic in mission control, because while they could explore whether or not those tiles they could see were missing might cause a flight safety risk, what they didn't know and had no way of checking was whether or not there might be tiles missing from another part of the airframe that was more critical. And as I say, NASA couldn't check. And so they phoned the Air Force, and it was the military, it was the NRO spy satellites that they brought to bear on the problem to see whether or not they might be able to establish whether Columbia was safe or not in 1981.
I love in relating the story as they were... one of the mission commanders came into mission control and said, everything's going to be okay. How do you know? I can't tell you. I loved how many times that popped up.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah, if I told you, I'd have to kill you. I mean, again, it's quite interesting listening to the press conference that was held throughout the flight, because journalists were rightly really concerned about the safety of Columbia. And it was Gene Kranz who held a lot of those press conferences, and people will remember him from Ed Harris playing him in Apollo 13, you know, failure is not an option. And journalists would say, look, how do you know? What are you using to check Columbia? And he'd say, well, we're using telescopes. And they'd say, well, are you using anything other than telescopes? Because you've already told us the pictures you're getting from telescopes are no good. He said, I can't tell you that. It's classified. And he kept having to try to keep them at bay, and they'd be asking about other. And all he said was, I cannot tell you more. This is classified. And as you mentioned somebody coming into mission control, it was Gene Kranz who brought those photographs in, which the NRO had shared with him. And, this was the first time that the NRO had managed to take pictures of another spacecraft and get them back to Earth while that spacecraft was still performing its sort of brief 3-day mission. And so get them back to Earth at a time where they could still be useful. And so it was, as I say, it was kind of right at the vanguard of what technologically was possible and what experts in the military and at NASA thought they might be capable of doing. I mean, it's a great testament to the closeness of the relationship, actually, between America's civilian and military space programs, that when a crisis looked like it might be looming, they came together and were able to reassure NASA that, all else being equal, Columbia and John Young and Bob Crippen riding her were going to be able to come home safely to Edwards Air Force Base.
Well, thank you for that untold part of the story and many other things I learned reading Into the Black. I appreciate it, Roland.
That's a great pleasure, Mark. Thanks for having me on the show.
The book is Into the Black, The Extraordinary Untold Story, The First Flight of the Space Shuttle Columbia and the Astronauts Who Flew Her, written by Roland White. Details about the book and his other books at our website, wvxu.org. This is The Book Club at 91.7.